Chapter 51.
"Can't be less than a million icebergs down there," said Giordino bleakly. "Be easier picking a midget head waiter out of a colony of penguins. This could take days."
Colonel Hollis was in the same mood.
"There has to be one matching the Lady Flamborough's contour and dimensions. Keep looking."
"Bear in mind," said Gunn, "Antarctic bergs tend to be flat. The superstructure under the plastic shroud will give the ship a multi-pinnacle shape." Dillinger's eye was enlarged 4 times its size through a magnifying glass.
"The definition is amazing," he muttered. "Be even better when we see what's on the other side of those clouds."
They were all grouped around a small table in the communications compartment of the sounder, examining a huge color photo from the Casper. The aerial reconnaissance film had been processed and sent through the survey ship's laser receiver less than 40 minutes after the aircraft landed. The well-defined detail showed a sea of bergs broken away from the Larsen ice shelf on the eastern side of the peninsula, while hundreds more could be distinguished near glaciers off Graham Land to the west. Pitt's concentration was aimed elsewhere. He sat off to one side, studying a large nautical chart draped across his lap. Once in a while he looked up, listening, but did not contribute to the conversation. Hollis turned to Captain Stewart, who stood next to the receiver, wearing a headset with attached microphone.
"When can we expect the Casper's infrared photo?"
Stewart raised a hand as a signal not to interrupt. He pressed the headset against his ears, listening to a voice at CIA headquarters in Washington. Then he nodded toward Hollis.
"The photo lab at Langley says they'll begin transmitting in half a minute."
Hollis paced the small compartment like a cat listening for the sound of a can opener. He paused and stared curiously at Pitt, who was unconcernedly measuring distances with a pair of dividers. The colonel had learned a great deal about the man from Numa in the past few hours, not from Pitt himself, but from the men on the ship. They talked of him as though he were some kind of walking legend.
"Coming through now," announced Stewart.
He removed the headset and waited patiently for the newspaper-sized photo to emerge from the receiver. As soon as it rolled free, he carried it over and placed it on the table. Then everyone began scrutinizing the shoreline around the upper end of the peninsula. "The technicians at the CIA photo lab have computer-converted the specially sensitive film to a thermogram," explained Stewart. "The differences of infrared radiation are revealed in various colors. Black represents the coldest temperatures. Dark blue, light blue, green, yellow, and red form an increasingly warmer scale to white, the hottest."
"What reading can we expect from the Lady Flamborough?" asked Dillinger.
"Somewhere in the upper end between yellow and red."
"Closer to a dark blue," Pitt broke in.
Everyone turned and glared at him as though he'd sneezed during a chess match.
"That being the case, she won't stand out," Hollis protested. "We'd never find her."
"Heat radiation from the engines and generators will show as plain as a golf ball on a green," Gunn argued.
"Not if the engineering room was shut down."
"You can't mean a dead ship," Dillinger asked in disbelief.
Pitt nodded. He stared at the others with a passing casual gaze that was more disturbing than if he had thrown a wet blanket over the enthusiasm of a breakthrough. He smiled and said,
"What we have here is a persistent urge to underrate the coach on the other team."
The 5 men looked at each other and then back at Pitt, waiting for some kind of explanation. Pitt laid his nautical charts aside and rose from his chair. He walked to the table, picked up the infrared photo, and folded it in half, revealing only the lower tip of Chile.
"Now then," Pitt continued,
"haven't you noticed that every time the ship went through a change of appearance or altered course, it came immediately after one of our satellites passed overhead?"
"Another example of precise planning," said Gunn.
"The orbits of scientific data-gathering satellites are tracked by half the countries of the world. The information is as readily attainable as phases of the moon."
"Okay, so the hijack leader knew the orbiting schedules and guessed when the satellite cameras were aimed in his direction," said Hollis. "So what?"
"So he covered all avenues and shut down power to prevent detection by infrared photography. And most important, to keep the warmth from melting the thin layer of ice coating the plastic shroud." 4 out of 5 found Pitt's theory quite plausible. The holdout was Gunn. He was the fastest intellect in the bunch. He saw the flaw before anyone else.
"You're forgetting the sub-zero temperatures around the peninsula," said Gunn.
"No power, no heat."
Everyone on the ship would freeze to death in a few hours. You might say the hijackers were committing suicide at the same time they murdered their prisoners.
Rudy makes good sense, Giordino said. They couldn't survive without some degree of warmth and protective clothing.
Pitt smiled like a lottery winner.
I agree with Rudy 100%.
You're driving in circles, said Hollis in aggravation. Makes sense.
Nothing complicated. The Lady Flamborough didn't enter the Antarctic.
Didn't enter the Antarctic, repeated Hollis mechanically.
Face the facts, man. The last satellite photo of the ship showed her halfway between Cape Horn and the tip of the peninsula, steaming hell-bent to the south.
She had no place else to go, protested Dillinger.
Pitt tapped a finger on the ragged mass of islands scattered around the Straits of Magellan.
Want a bet?
Hollis stood frowning, baffled for a moment, and then he caught on. His confusion vanished and total understanding beamed in his eyes.
She's doubled back, he said flatly.
Rudy had the key, Pitt acknowledged. The hijackers weren't about to commit suicide, nor were they going to risk detection by infrared photos. They never had any intention of heading into the ice pack. Instead, they cut northwest and skirted the barren islands above Cape Horn.
Gunn looked relieved.
The temperatures are not nearly as severe around Tierra del Fuego. Everyone on board would be damned uncomfortable without warmth, but they'd survive.
Then why the iceberg scam? Queried Giordino.
To appear as if they calved from a glacier.
Calved, like in cow?
Calving is the breaking away of an ice mass from an ice front or wall, Gunn clarified.
Giordino stared down at the infrared photo.
Glaciers this far north?
Several flow down the mountains and meet the sea within 800 kilometers from where we're docked here in Punta Arenas, replied Pitt.
Where do you reckon she is? Hollis asked.
Pitt took a chart showing the desolate fringe islands west of Tierra del Fuego. Two possibilities within the Lady Flamborough's sailing range since she was last spotted by satellite. He paused to place an X beside two names on the chart.
Directly south of here, glaciers flow from Mounts Italia and Sarmiento.
Hollis said, they're off the beaten track all right.
But too close to the oil fields, said Pitt. A low-flying oil company survey plane might notice the phony ice cover.
Me, if I was calling the plays for the hijackers, I'd head another 160 kilometers northwest, which would put them near a glacier on Santa Inez Island.
Dillinger studied the small island's irregular shoreline on the chart for a moment. He glanced at the colored photograph, but the southern foot of Chile was blotted by clouds. He pushed it aside and peered through the magnifying glass at the upper half of the infrared image Pitt had folded to condense the search region.
After a few seconds, he looked up in wonder and delight.
Unless Mother Nature makes icebergs with a pointed bow and a rounded stern, I think we've found our phantom ship.
Hollis took the glass from his subordinate and examined the tiny oblong shape.
It's the right contour, all right. And as Pitt said, there's no sign of heat radiation. She's reading almost as cold as the glacier. Not quite pure black, but a very dark blue.
Gunn leaned in.
Yes, I see. The glacier flows into a fjord that empties in a bay crowded with small islands. One or two medium-sized bergs broken from the glacial wall, no more. The water is reasonably free of ice.
He paused, a curious expression in the eyes behind the glasses.
I wonder why they moored the Lady Flamborough directly under the glacier's forward wall.
Pitt's eyes narrowed.
Let me have a look.
He squeezed between Dillinger and Gunn, bent over and gazed through the powerful glass. After a time he straightened, his face clouded with a rising anger.
What do you see? Asked Captain Stewart.
They mean for everyone to die.
Stewart looked at the others, puzzled.
How does he know?
When an ice slab fractures off the glacier and falls on the ship, Giordino said stonily, she'll be shoved under the water and mashed into the bottom. No trace of her would ever be found.
Dillinger gave Pitt a hard look.
After all the lost opportunities, do you think they finally intend to murder the crew and passengers?
I do.
Why not before now?
The myriad of deceptions was a stall for time. Whoever ordered the hijacking had reasons for keeping Presidents Hassan and De Lorenzo alive. I can't tell you why.
I can, said Hollis. Ahmad Yazid is the instigator. He planned to take control of Egypt soon after it was announced that President Hassan and UN Secretary General Hala Kamil were abducted and presumed killed by unknown terrorists at sea.
After he and his close supporters established a solid power base, he would claim his agents had found the ship, and then act the benevolent man of God and negotiate the hostage's release.
Crafty bastard, murmured Giordino. A Nobel Peace Prize candidate for sure if he saved President De Lorenzo and Senator Pitt as a bonus.
Naturally, Yazid would see that Hassan and Camille met with an unfortunate accident on their return to Egypt.
And he'd still come out pure as the driven snow, Giordino grunted.
A grand sting, admitted Pitt. Yet according to the latest news reports, the military has remained neutral and Hassan's cabinet has refused to resign and fold the present government.
Hollis nodded. Yes, throwing Yazid's carefully calculated schedule out the window.
So he's plotted himself into a corner, said Pitt. End of stalling tactics, end of masquerades. This time around he has to send the Lady Flamborough into oblivion, or face the very real threat of intelligence sources ferreting out his role in the operation.
A theory with no leaks, agreed Hollis.
So, while we stand here, the hijack leader is playing Russian roulette with the glacier, said Gunn in a low voice. He and his terrorist team may have already abandoned the ship and escaped by boat or helicopter, leaving the crew and passengers confined below, helpless.
Could be we've missed the boat, Dillinger speculated somberly.
Hollis didn't see it that way. He scribbled a number on a slip of paper and handed it to Stewart. Captain, please signal my communications officer on this frequency. Tell him the Major and I are returning to the airfield and to assemble the men for an immediate briefing.
We'd like to go along, said Pitt with quiet determination.
Hollis shook his head. No way, you're civilians. You've had no assault training. Your request is out of line.
My father is on that ship.
I'm sorry, he said, but didn't sound it. Write it off to tough luck.
Pitt looked at Hollis, and his eyes were very cold.
One call to Washington, and I could queer your entire service career.
Hollis's mouth tightened.
You get your kicks making threats, Mr. Pitt?
He took a step forward.
We're not playing touch football here. A lot of bodies are going to mess the decks of that ship in the next 12 hours. If my men and I do our jobs the way we've been trained, 1,000 phone calls to the White House and Congress won't make a damn.
He took another step toward Pitt.
I know more rotten tricks than you'd learn in a lifetime. I could tear you to shreds with my bare hands.
No one in the room saw the movement, saw where it came from. One instant Pitt was standing casually with his arms at his sides. The next he was pressing the muzzle of a Colt 45 caliber automatic into Hollis's groin.
Dillinger crouched as if ready to spring. That was as far as he got. Giordino came from behind and pinned the Major's arms to his sides in a bear hug that clamped like a steel trap.
I won't bore you with our resumes, Pitt said calmly. Take my word, Rudy, Al, and I have enough experience to hold our own in a shooting war. I promise we won't interfere. I presume you'll lead your special operations forces against the Lady Flamborough in a combined air and sea assault. We'll stay out of your way and follow from the land side.
Hollis was far from frightened, but he was dazed. He couldn't begin to imagine how Pitt produced a large-caliber weapon with such lightning speed.
Dirk is asking little of you, Colonel, said Gunn in a patient tone. I suggest you demonstrate a small degree of mature logic and go along.
I don't believe for a second you'd murder me, growled Hollis at Pitt.
No, but I can guarantee you won't have a very productive sex life.
Who are you people? Are you with the company?
The CIA, said Giordino.
No, we didn't qualify, so we enlisted with NUMA instead.
Hollis shook his head.
I don't understand any of this.
You don't have to, said Pitt. Is it a deal?
Hollis considered for half a second. Then he leaned forward until his nose was only a few millimeters from Pitt's, and spoke as would a drill instructor to a raw recruit. I'll see you weirdos are airlifted by an Osprey to within 10 kilometers of the ship. No closer or we'll lose the element of surprise. From there you can damn well hike in. If I'm lucky, you won't arrive until it's all over.
Fair enough, Pitt agreed.
Hollis backed off then. He looked at Giordino and snapped, I'd be grateful if you'd release my second in command.
Then he refaced Pitt.
We're shoving off, now. In fact, if you don't leave with Major Dillinger and me, you ain't going. Because 5 minutes after boarding my command aircraft, our entire assault team will be airborne.
Pitt eased the automatic from Hollis's groin.
We'll be right behind you.
I'll tag along with the Major, said Giordino, giving Dillinger a friendly pat on the back. Great minds run in the same channels.
Dillinger gave him a sour look indeed. Yours might well run in a gutter, but mine don't.
The room cleared out in 15 seconds. Pitt hurried to his cabin and snatched up a tote bag. He made a quick trip to the bridge and conversed with Captain Stewart. How long for the sounder to reach Santa Ynez? Stewart stepped into the chart room and made a quick calculation.
Pushing throttles to the stops, our diesel should put us off the glacier in 9 or 10 hours.
Do it, Pitt ordered. We'll look for you around dawn.
Stewart shook Pitt's hand.
You take care, you hear?
I'll try not to get my feet wet.
One of the ship's scientists stepped over from the bridge counter. He was black, medium height, and wore a stern expression that looked as if it was chiseled there. His name was Clayton Findlay, and he spoke in a deep, rich bass voice.
"Excuse me for eavesdropping, gentlemen, but I could have sworn you mentioned Santa Ynez Island."
Pitt nodded. "Yes, that's right."
"There's an old zinc mine near the glacier. Closed down when Chile halted government-subsidized production."
"You're familiar with the island?" Pitt asked in surprise. Findlay nodded.
"I was chief geologist of an Arizona mining company who thought they might make the mine pay through efficient, cost-cutting operations. They sent me down along with a couple of engineers to make a survey. Spent 3 months in that hellhole. We found the ore grade about played out. Soon after, the mine was shuttered and the equipment abandoned."
"How are you with a rifle?"
"I've hunted some."
Pitt took him by the arm.
"Clayton, my friend, you are a gift from the gods.